to give you a couple of minutes to get used to my accent. I have been traveling on a ticket that allows me to go on standby basis as much as I want within the USA for 30 days. And I was counting the cities today that I will cover by the end of the 30 days. There are 17 cities. So I tell you, it's exhausting, but it's great to take advantage of this opportunity and see many people. 3 years ago, I was here and I was using the same ticket. And I remember one time I was in the church, in one church, and I was so tired that I started sleeping. And as I kind of began dozing, I found myself reaching for the seat belts. Another experience I had in the States, one time I was invited to a conference in Seattle, and it was a missionary conference. And the man who invited me told me there will be many people coming, many speakers, so I will not be able to meet you at the airport, but someone will meet you. I said, how will he recognize me? He said, don't worry, you look Arab enough. So I said, well, here's our family picture, you know, just in case he might not recognize me. So I went there assuming that the man has the picture and that he will recognize me. So as I came out of the, of the airplane through the tunnel, I found about 8 to 9 men, people standing waiting there, and one of them, nice, handsome, good looking, you know, standing with a big smile looking at people. And as I came out, he was smiling to me. I thought, this must be him. So I went to him and I said, hi. He said, hi. I said, my name is Nabil Jabu. He said, nice meeting you. I said, are you coming to meet me? He said, nope. And then there were two shy navigators. A third story, but a very serious one. Well, I was, I think it was last visit, 1988, I was in Portland. And a young man I met just before the meeting, he said, do you remember me? I looked at him and I said, no. I said, what's your name? So he told me his name. I said, your name sounds familiar. Have you been praying for us? He said, let me tell you a story. I said, do you remember 4 years ago in Seattle in that missionary conference? You gave a report about Egypt and you gave us a challenge that was too difficult. And then you asked us to commit ourselves, whoever wants, to pray almost daily for 1 year. And I thought, that's ridiculous. I've never done anything like that. If it was 2 weeks, maximum 1 month, it is possible. For 1 year, that's too much. And he said, after the meeting, I started thinking about it. And I thought, why don't I try? And then I committed myself to pray almost daily for a year. And he told me, I want to tell you something. I've been praying for you for the last 4 years almost daily. I tell you, I was overwhelmed. No wonder the last 15 years in Egypt have been the best years in my life. We've enjoyed it, you know, in spite of the difficulties that, you know, living in Cairo involves. I tell you, I'd rather be nowhere else in the whole world other than Cairo, Egypt. For those of you that do not know enough about Egypt, Egypt is a big country, but only 4% of it is inhabited. That 4% is exactly the same size like Holland. Mm. Holland is considered to be the most densely populated country in the world. It has 15 million people. On the same area of land in Egypt, you have 57 million people. Cairo is a city made for 4 million. Now it has 16 to 17 million people. We waited 9 years to get our phone. Now it's much better. It takes less time. I read several years ago in a newspaper that the inhabitants of Cairo inhale the equivalent of 38 cigarettes a day. A certain American missionary lady who was living in Cairo, she came to the States for furlough. She had a checkup, physical checkup. They told her, you're fine, but you need to reduce your smoking. She said, I don't smoke. You know, I hate Cairo as a city, but I tell you, I'd rather be nowhere else in the whole world. I have never met any people like the Egyptians that have such a desire to live for God and such a fear of God, awe of God. I heard the Sudanese are even better, but I haven't had the chance to be in fellowship with Sudanese. Well, about 5 years ago in our ministry, we started facing a major question. The question is, would an Islamic state in Egypt start one day in the future? And so we started asking people, and as a team we started meeting together and discussing three main questions. The first question is, would Egypt become an Islamic state like Iran one day? Everybody said yes, definitely. The second question, what form would that take? Some people say severe, others say moderate. Third question, what should we be doing now in order to be ready for it when it happens? And I tell you that third question became the question, became the lens through which everything was decided. I tell you, everything we decide, everything we talk about had to do with the third question. What should we be doing right now in order to be ready for it when it happens? For instance, soon after we started these discussions, I started having an obsessive fear of death. Not death, actually burial. Why? Because in Cairo, there are two cemeteries for the Protestants. One for the Egyptian Protestants and one for the American missionaries. The one for the American missionaries, you have, you know, regular cemetery. Each person, you know, each corpse will have place by the length of his body. The Egyptians, what they do is they build like a room, a big room, with one door and no windows, and they have shelves inside. And so it is made for an extended family. And so the person that dies, they put him on a shelf, somebody else, another shelf, and so on. In my case, I thought, what if something happens and I get killed or I die in Egypt, because we were planning to stay to the rest of our lives. What if I die in Egypt? What will my wife do? And I really started worrying. And so I thought the best thing to do is to go and talk to my Egyptian pastor. As I told him my concern, and I was very serious, I was talking to him. So he laughed and he said, don't worry, you die and I'll bury you. Well, that really didn't minister to me. So I went to a friend of mine, and by the way, I'm going to mention one name and repeatedly, you know, mention that name. Maybe God will put him on your heart to pray for him. Went to a friend of mine called Samuel, and he's on the team, and he's now the director of the Navigators. I said to him, Samuel, I'm concerned about what might happen if I die here in Egypt. And I told him my thinking. He told me, Barbara, your wife will have a different problem than you're expecting. There will be so many people offering to have you being buried in their place that she will not know who to say yes to and who to say no. He said, if it makes you feel better, you're welcome to be buried in our place of burial. I said, man, I'll feel honored that I will be in the Fawzi Khair family. And I tell you, from that time on, my problem was solved. Then, a year ago, Bob Vedano, the director of the Navigators in the Middle East, came to me and he said, you know, you have been for 15, you know, almost 14 years in Egypt at that time, and you've never had a furlough longer than 2 months. Your wife has never had a furlough since 1968, since she moved to Lebanon, before Egypt. He said, she's weary, she's tired, you're tired, you need a change. How about June 1991, taking a year off? And go to the States for a 1 year sabbatical. Your son will be graduating from high school. He needs to be in university. And you could be with him in his first year, you know. And he began telling me about all these arguments. And it was really nice to the ear to hear something like this. Somebody who's responsible for the ministry is loving me enough to want the best for me. Man, I felt privileged. But then I found myself telling him, I said, Bob, this is a fantastic idea. But what if 5 years from now an Islamic State takes place in Egypt or a revolution takes place in Egypt? Do you want me to be out 1 year outside the country in order to have a sabbatical? I don't think I'll ever leave Egypt unless I'm kicked out. Then I thought maybe I'm too hard on my wife and my children. So I went to Samuel. And I said, Samuel, what do you think? This is what Bob told me. He said, man, it's a fantastic opportunity. You really need it. You both of you need it. It will be a fantastic change. You will read new books. You kind of, you know. And he started telling me more arguments why it's good. But then he said, but what if an Islamic revolution takes place in a few years' time? Do you want to miss a whole year outside Egypt? You see how the third question evaluates everything we do? I said, man, this is exactly what I told Bob Vedano. And I added to Bob Vedano, I'll never leave unless I'm kicked out. Well, I'm kicked out. And I've been traveling, etc. By June 1991, I think I'll begin my sabbatical. So I don't think I am kicked out. I've graduated from Egypt by God's grace. Back in 1974, 1 year before we moved to Egypt, we were attending a conference and we planned a training program. Some Lebanese people and a group of Egyptians met together and planned a training program. And then as we planned the whole thing, You know, we agreed on the schedule and we thought everything is fine. So we started the training program and I was following the schedule very closely. And I found myself at 7 in the morning waking up. Everybody is still having, you know, sleeping, still sleeping in. After lunch, I am ready to have man-to-man with people, but everybody is having a siesta. At night at 11, I'm in bed, like the schedule says. I'm the only one in the room. Everybody is having a great time downstairs. And I'm boiling, you know. And I say, these Egyptians are not disciplined, you know, and not like the Lebanese, you know, this attitude. I kept like that for 2 days. And then I decided to follow the schedule which is in here. It seems there's a written schedule and another schedule. And everybody is in agreement about that one. So I decided to follow that one. And I tell you, I really started enjoying Egypt for the first time in my life. I found during the singing, I'll worship the Lord with all my heart and with tears. By the last night, I was playing basketball at 3 a.m. with the people in the conference. During that time, God invaded me and I felt it's the greatest privilege to go and live in Egypt and serve God in Egypt. Before that, I was resisting. People will tell me, why don't you come to Egypt? I say, well, God has called me to Lebanon. And I had very good argument to give them. But you know, I thank God for that opportunity because I hear that people can go as missionaries to a country with two kind of attitudes, two different kinds of attitudes. One kind is to go and jump into the culture and hold your nose. The culture is too much, you know, like a diving pool. It's deep water. You throw yourself in and you hold your nose because you cannot bear the culture. And every now and then, as soon as possible, you leave this culture and go with your friends from your, like in my case, the Lebanese and the British. My wife is British. And breathe clean air or English Lebanese air, as it were. That's one approach. The other approach I was told many years ago is to go with the intent of committing suicide. And that means throwing yourself in the diving pool, very deep water, and you begin breathing the culture. You want to commit suicide. And I tell you, this was what we have chosen to do. The first year we didn't have a car by choice. And we decided not to use the taxi, although the taxi was about 25 cents, you know. And we will wait for the bus, all, you know, to pay 1 cent or 2 cents for the bus. Sometimes to go one place to another, you have to change 3 buses. I remember one time with Fuad, Jim will remember him, Fuad Libbos. You know, going at night home from downtown at around 11 p.m. and waiting, we took the first bus and we took the second bus and we waited for about 40 minutes for the third bus and we were dragging our feet to the stop, to the bus station. And then we saw the bus coming and man, we were running for our lives because as if we miss this bus, we have to wait another 45 minutes. And now I look at it, how did we do that, you know? Why didn't we take a taxi? I thank God that that was not an option at that time. That allowed us to breathe the culture. And I tell you, in Egypt, our friends are only the Egyptians. We didn't have neither Lebanese nor British friends. And we enjoyed every bit of it. We heard that the Egyptians draw 2 circles around themselves. The outer circle is very easy to get into, especially if you are a foreigner. But the inner one, only the relatives and very close friends are allowed to come in. We found there is a third circle, an inner circle. And that is to be allowed not to enter the home, the living room, have a Pepsi or something like this, but to enter the holy of holies of people's lives. And I tell you, we have been privileged through our couples ministry to go into the secrets, to be acquainted with the deepest secrets of many peoples. And I find one of the highlights of our time in Egypt is coming back at night, Barbara and I, and praying for the people we have been visiting. Sometimes we feel like crying. Some other times we're so happy we can't go to sleep. But what a privilege it is for us that God honored us to allow us to be there for 15 years. Well, as we went to Egypt, we prayed and we said, Lord, you know, what shall we do? And we didn't have much freedom to imitate the model of Lebanon, you know, typical student ministry, going to the dorm, witnessing, etc. If we did that in Egypt, we will be arrested from the second day. So we didn't have the choice of copying anything we knew. So we started praying, Lord, what shall we do? How can we make an impact on the country? And if you look at the population of Egypt, it's 57 million, I mentioned, mostly Muslims, Some people say 80% to 90%. I don't know. Let's say 80%. Then the Orthodox will be 19%, then half of 1% Catholics and half of 1% Protestants. If we started a ministry with Protestants, discipleship ministry, I tell you, we could have had enough numbers to have big numbers coming for these Bible study and discipleship groups. Because Cairo alone has 16 million. So even half of 1%, that's multitudes in Egypt. And anybody who would have visited us would have been impressed by the number of people that are being discipled, number of people in Bible study group, etc. Instead, we started praying, Lord, how can we make an impact on the nation? Because Matthew 13:33 says something like this. I'm translating now from Arabic. It says, the kingdom of God is like a woman that put yeast in three containers of dough. Let's make it four containers. Now, if she put yeast in one container, does that mean all the dough is yeasted? Definitely not. Only the pot that she put the yeast in. So we thought, how can we be used by God to put yeast among the Protestants, among the Catholics, among the Orthodox, and among the Muslims? Otherwise, we're just working in one little group. And that's not making an impact on the nation. So this was our major prayer. And some of you heard me in 1988. How many of you were here? I don't want to be repetitive. Okay, I'll go very briefly on one part and then share with you the latest. God gave me the privilege to meet for 10 years with a priest. Let's call him Father X because it's confidential. That means if you know of Egyptians, don't go and tell them, I've heard about a priest in Egypt. His name is Father X. It won't take long and he will guess who Father X is. Okay, so please don't share it with anybody, especially Egyptians. Well, briefly, he was ordained in 1960. Four years later, he accepted the Lord and started preaching the gospel. And a revival took place among the Orthodox. Now, the church leadership was so annoyed by his Protestant approach to evangelism because many Protestants started giving him gifts, Protestant books and pamphlets. So he started reading these books and preaching the way he read. And the leadership of the church did not like that, so they stopped him from preaching. Finally, anyway, the years went by. He moved to Cairo. By the time we moved in 1975, there were about 3,000 people attending the church that he preached at every Thursday evening, along with the hall and next to it with closed-circuit TV. Well, we prayed, Lord, lead us to people, to key people that can make an impact on the Orthodox. And 2 years later, in 1977, two young men came and they said, we are from the team of Father X. We heard you're with the Navigators. Could you come and give us two lectures to the team of Father X, two lectures on how to make disciples? I said, you can make disciples by hearing lectures. You make disciples by being disciples yourselves. If I'll meet with you, it should be at least for 3 months to finish a booklet together that I had written in Egypt. Then I said, did you ask for the permission of Father X before you came to see me? He said, of course not. I said, why not? He said, of course he won't let us meet with a Protestant. I said, don't come again without his permission. The principle is, I didn't want to go over the wall, but through the door. Well, to my surprise, the next day one of them came and he said he'd like to meet you. So we met for an hour and a half. He wasn't impressed by what I shared with him, but he allowed me to meet with five of his key men for 3 months. 4 weeks later, he came back from Alexandria as he was having a month holiday, and he sent me somebody to call me right away. I went there. Rather than meeting in his office this time, we met in the third floor like an attic. He locked the door as we went in, and then he prayed, and then after he prayed, he said, I've been thinking and praying about what we talked about for the last month. Will you consider me as a convert who has accepted Christ today, and will you disciple me so I will learn to disciple others? I tell you, I couldn't believe my ears. Here is a man who was like the Billy Graham of the Middle East. He has baptized more than 300 Muslim converts. Maybe the missionary who has lived now to his age is 80 in one of the Arab countries. In his lifetime, he has baptized maybe about 25 Muslim converts. So this man, in a short time, relatively, baptized 300 Muslim converts. In addition to the many, 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 maybe in thousands, that have come to know the Lord through his ministry among the Orthodox. Well, when he told me this, I couldn't believe my ears. So I shared with him a principle, the principle I believe in it with from the deepest part of my being. It says, train a man, I learned it from Libres and added few words to it. Train a man and he will become what you are. Serve and develop a man who's caught with vision and is dedicated to God. And the sky is the limit. So let me say it again. Train a man, suppose I'm the man, I am training somebody else. Train a man and he will become what you are. Sooner or later I'll become the ceiling, the bottleneck. He can't go beyond me because that's what I am. I'm standing in his way. He can't go beyond me. Train a man and he will become what you are. Serve and develop a man who's caught with vision and is dedicated to God and the sky is the limit. If I push him up, soon he'll keep going and I can't push anymore. Somebody else will carry on the process. So I shared this principle with him. And I said, Father X, I am a Protestant, as you know, and it's hard for me to kiss the hand of any man. But I want to tell you, as the Orthodox kiss the hand of the priest, every time I see you, I want to kiss your hand to remind myself that my position is not here, but here. So we had like a tradition for 10 years. By the way, we met for 10 years every Saturday, except for the 2 months of the summer, for about 2.5 to 3 hours. Every time we meet, I go for his arm, and you know, he pulls it out, he doesn't let me hold his hand, and he hugs me. So that's what we've done for 10 years. Well, I don't want to be repetitive for you, those of you that heard me, but all I want to say, that the last year, he got reconciled with the patriarch, etc., but the last year, they assigned him to a church in a very densely populated part of Cairo that has many Muslim fundamentalists. And the church that he preached at had about, can take up to 250 people. When he started preaching, they gave him Saturday evening as his turn to preach, and there were two other priests in that church. So he started preaching on Saturday. Soon the church started filling in, and it more and more until they crammed into it the 250. But more people came, so they started using the courtyard with closed circuit TV. Then more people then started using the roof, and our, you know, churches, we can't afford making, you know, roofs like this. It's flat, so we can use the next floor. So they started using everything available around, and I don't know how they crammed 2,000 every Saturday night into that place. He told me that over a period of 1 year, he has led individually to the Lord, one by one, more than 1,000 converts in 1 year by using the Orthodox forms. One of the things I thank God for is that I felt God used me with him, is to help him maintain his biblical content or theology, but learn to present it in an Orthodox form so he will not look foreign or Protestant. And that's why the church was against him. If he used the forms that the church fathers talked about, and it was abundant as he studied them in the church fathers, he can, you know, minister among the Orthodox with no problem whatsoever. Well, for instance, after every message, if he gave a Protestant invitation, it will sound awful in the Orthodox church. Like, if you want to accept Christ, raise your hand or come forward or sing the song, Here I Am or I Come. How does it go? Just as I am, you know, that hymn. Instead, he gave an Orthodox invitation. What he would say is that, he says, you are in the presence of the Almighty God. And when you are in his presence, you come before him in humility. And what happens is an encounter with God himself. That should produce repentance. Are you repentant before God? Or are you half-hearted? If you're really repentant, demonstrate your repentance by going to your father of confession. Now, most of them want to go to him. So, that's why he refused to attend funerals or weddings. And that's where most of the priests want to go, because that's where the money comes. Instead, he gave his time to listening to confessions. 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. He didn't go visiting. His time was given to listening to confessions. He had an office, and unlike the Orthodox, there is no paravan between the confessor and the priest. It's just like an office, an ordinary office. And outside there is a waiting room and a secretary behind her the desk, and she has already every day full, each person 15 minutes, maximum 20 minutes. And the whole day is filled, and every week is filled. And nobody dares to miss, because if you miss, you have to wait another month for your turn to come. So everybody comes right on time. And So the person comes on time and there's no time to waste in breaking the ice or something like this. So he comes ready to repent. He's rehearsing what he wants to say to the priest on his way as he's coming to that waiting room. And as he goes in and outside in the waiting room, there are two men and two women to help him. Well, the young man goes in, let's say, and for the first 5 minutes, he begins pouring out his sins. So Father X shares with him 1 John 1:9. Then he says, but I have good news for you today. He gets out a paper and opens the Bible and draws to him an illustration he made up. He calls the cross illustration. And he invites that person to accept the Lord. And the person accepts the Lord. Then he tells him, start reading the Bible. That person goes out, another person goes in. When he goes out, the two men tell him, come and sit with us for a while. What happened inside? So he tells them the story. So they find out, does it sound like a genuine decision? If so, they share with him verses on assurances. Then they show him how to do the quiet time. A month later comes his turn again. When he comes the second time, he starts with first 5 minutes confessing to the priest. And then he tells him 1 John 1:9, but he says, now it's different. Now you are a child of God. And then he tells him, how are you doing with your quiet time? And they do the quiet time together. He goes out, sits with the two young men, and they ask him, what happened inside? And so on. And so over a period of 1 year, he led a minimum of 1,000 people to Christ using Orthodox forms. I thank God for that. There is hope. You know, the Catholics, they have their own ministry in Catholic context. The Orthodox have their own ministry with the Orthodox. You know, I feel even we Protestants, you know, we are the least disciplined among them. The profile of the Orthodox is harder than our profiles. The 2-7 that he came up with, equivalent of the 2-7, it's fantastic. I think it's better than our 2-7. And instead of quoting Tozer and Billy Graham and others, he quotes Athanasius, Clement of Alexandria, and St. Augustine and others. And it sounds genuine. And as he read the teachings of the fathers, he found the stuff that is really rich. Like, for instance, discipleship is not the invention of the Protestants. The whole monastic order emphasizes discipleship. So why not take advantage of it? Anyway, another priest started coming on the horizon. Let's call him Father Y. Father X and Father Y. This priest is very famous now all over Egypt. And he's attracting people, about 3,500 people, to come to his retreats once a month when he makes them. Well, I was so sad to find out that his approach is like Father X's old approach, very Protestant. And I began kind of praying for him, and I thought, does this man have to make all the mistakes that Father X did in the past? And then I thought, maybe I can meet him, but who am I to meet him? You know, people after the, you know, in the break time during these retreats, there will be 40 people in the queue waiting to sit with him for 5 minutes so that either he'll bless them or pray for them or give them an advice or something or another. So, you know, I thought, but then I went to Father X and I said, how about, you know, you go and meet him and share with him about what you have discovered that the church fathers teach. Maybe, you know, he doesn't have to go through what you have done through. And Father X really suffered a great deal, you know, in his relationship with the patriarch. Finally, a complete reconciliation took place. So he said, that's great. So one day, he decided to buy all the books of Father Y and read them and listen to many of his tapes. And one day he came on a Saturday evening and Father X told me, I don't think I can make it. I said, why? He said, look what he says in this book. He says, be careful of people that come and advise you a different advice from what we do in our ministry. Because these people could come representing the devil, but appearing like angels of light. He said, what if he thinks of me as a devil coming as an angel of light? So, you know, the opportunity went, and Father X had to leave the country, and he's now in Australia because the secret police was giving him a hard time, and he was imprisoned for 10 months earlier, etc. So he left the country. So last summer, I was really burdened for Father Y, and I thought, Lord, what can I do? And I really prayed and I asked, God, give me an opportunity. And so a couple in our ministry, I found that the wife is a doctor, the man is an engineer. She used to be in Father Y's ministry years ago. So I told her, can you arrange an appointment with him for me? She said, I'll try. And he lives in a city about 4 hours called Minya, 4 hours by train south of Cairo. So the weekend that I was going there for our ministry, she arranged for me time with him. And I've heard that he is a man that really tries to be led by the Spirit, but to an exaggerated degree. I heard that, for instance, if somebody wants to, if he says to somebody, "I'm coming to visit you on Tuesday in Cairo," the person says, "What time?" He says, "I don't know. When the Lord leads me to come, I will come." So that man stays the whole day waiting. He could come at 10 in the morning, he could come at 2 in the afternoon, or at 11 at night, or might not come at all because the Lord might not lead him. So I tell you, I was afraid of how will I talk with him, and how will, So I went there and we had 45 minutes together. I told him about what Dawson Trotman did with Billy Graham. He wasn't impressed. He said, "We do all this kind of thing." I didn't tell him anything about Father X. But whatever I said, he kind of indicated, "We do it. We don't need it." Then I shared with him the principle. Train a man and he will become what you are. Serve and develop a man who's caught with vision and is dedicated to God, and the sky is the limit. I said, "I know you read one brand of books. I would like, if you allow me to serve you, to read with you variety of books, so that you'll be exposed to variety, of ideas." And, as we talked about it, when I talked about that principle, all of a sudden, his face changed. And I started sensing that God did something at that moment. And I said, "Would you like to pray? I know you pray and you are led by the Spirit before you make any decision. Will you pray regarding the possibility of getting to meet together once every 2 weeks when you come to Cairo? Or once a month, or when 2 weeks later when I come down to Minya?" He said, "I don't need to pray about it. I believe it's from the Lord." And after a few minutes, I said, "I think you better pray about it, because I know you like to be led by the Spirit." He said, "I don't need to pray about it. I think this is from the Lord." And after a while, we talk some more, then I go back to the same theme. And I tell him, "Are you sure? Don't you think it's better to pray about it?" He said, "I don't need to pray about it. It is from the Lord. I sense this is from God." At the end of the time, I told him, "Look, I am a Protestant, and as you know, we don't kiss hands, but I want to every time meet you to kiss your hand to remind myself that I am not here, but I am here." So I came to him like the past, thinking that he will pull out his hand. He didn't pull his hand, so I kissed his hand. To my surprise, he kissed my hand and then he hugged me. What he was telling me: "I accept you as a brother. When I learned that I need to leave the country, I sent him a message. I had only 10 days. I sent him a message telling him I'm leaving in a few days." He had a retreat for 3,500 people and he was the speaker. He asked other people to speak. And he came to Cairo and we had 1 hour and a half. I tell you, I'll never forget that time. He's one of the godliest men I've met. If there's anything in Egypt I feel unfinished, it was my time with this man. Everything else we do, people took over. When we went to Egypt, we didn't plan to make an organization. We hardly used the name The Navigators. We wanted to make an impact, and a movement started. You can't kind of put it around or name it something. If somebody comes and tells me, "How many Navigator disciples you have?" Zero. But if they ask, "How many Orthodox disciples?" Man, I don't know. Ask the man responsible. So it cannot be put in a square or something like this. But the amazing thing, in the last 10 days, an organization was formed that the men wanted to carry the responsibility and own the ministry. Now they have chosen a new name and they have taken over the responsibility. And Bob Vedano visits, I write letters and make telephone calls. And when he came the last time, last month he was there, he came rejoicing. I envy him for the privilege of visiting Egypt. Well, time is running. Let me see, what should I share? Regarding the ministry with Muslims, let me tell you a caricature story that communicates a little bit the approach that has existed for hundreds of years in a ministry with Muslims. Christians in the Middle East see themselves as a minority. Like, suppose I am a young Egyptian, a young man, Christian Egyptian. I feel like I am living within a castle surrounded by multitudes of Muslims. And these multitudes sooner or later want to turn Egypt into an Islamic state. And therefore we people within the castle, whether we are nominal Christians or born again Christians, we should love one another, help one another, get educated. learn languages and immigrate. Whenever one person immigrates, he starts pulling the rest of his family one by one. Well, this was the kind of the the idea that you'll find existing in a situation like this. Suppose one day I come to our youth group and I find there is a guest speaker, and this guest speaker is a Muslim convert. Boy, that's amazing. You hardly hear of one. Once in a blue moon. This is very rare. So this fellow gives his testimony, and I feel, man, here's one of them saying that we are right and they are wrong. Our Bible is right and their book is wrong. Boy, it makes me feel good because I always hear the other point of view. I'm always told the other way around. So I sit and really enjoy the meeting. Here's somebody who's kind of, it makes me feel good. After the meeting, I congratulate him and everybody congratulates him. And he feels like there's a halo around his head. Now he thinks this is the best church. So he keeps coming to this church. Next time he comes, he's not the speaker, nor giving a testimony or anything. So he feels like an ordinary person, and even less than an ordinary person. Why? Because, let's say, after the meeting, I see him talking to my sister. Right away, what I'm brainwashed comes to my mind. As a child, I was brainwashed never to trust a Muslim convert. He either wants money, or he wants to marry a beautiful Christian girl, or he wants to go to America. Now, I see him talking to my sister, and I begin wondering. Now, that's why, you know. And so I go and talk to my sister and tell her, look, we don't know. We are not sure he is a convert yet. We better wait until we are very sure, this kind of thing. And I can share with her few verses to win my argument. But this man begins suffering in the church. He doesn't have a problem with assurance of salvation. He doesn't have a problem with God. God already accepted him. His problem is with us. His problem is the greatest need he has is a need for belongingness. And so he feels he's suspected, he's not trusted. So he goes to the pastor and he says, I want to be baptized. Not because he wants to obey Jesus, but because he wants to prove to us that he has become one of us. He has burnt all his bridges. He's one of us. So he gets baptized and changes his name from Mustafa. Have you heard of this name? Or Muhammad. Have you heard of Muhammad? Yeah. To, let's say, Peter, rather than Butrus, the Arabic word for it. And English, Peter, you know. Peter in Egypt doesn't sound very kind of... Well, actually, one day I met a man like this, and his name is Peter, you know, and I thought, boy, these people are very westernized. This family is very westernized. As I was talking to him, I said, he told me, look, I'm a Muslim convert. I said, really? I said, yes. I said, what's your original name? He said, Muhammad. I said, why did you change your name? He said, how do you expect me to be called Muhammad in a church? Brother, Muhammad, they don't go together. So I changed my name to make it easy for you Christians. What a motive to be baptized. Well, anyway, he gets baptized. And then still there is suspicion. And after a while, he comes with another fancy story. A real story. The story is he fought with his dad because he attacked Islam and attacked the Quran. And he said Christianity is right and Islam is wrong. And he attacked the Prophet. So the dad took the Bible, tore it to pieces, threw it on the floor and kicked that young man from the house. And that young man lost his inheritance. Now he comes and we give him another opportunity to share his testimony. How he was persecuted for Jesus' sake. Now the halo returns. But after the meeting, where will he sleep? If he comes to our home, what if the secret police is following him? We can't have him in our home. So we begin thinking, do we know of anybody that works at the American embassy? Or at the British embassy? Or at the French embassy? So we can help him get a visa and immigrate. This is a caricature picture, but I tell you, it represents history for hundreds of years of evangelism to Muslims in the Middle East. Well, we aimed in Egypt not to have converts. And if I tell you, if you ask me how many converts did you have, it will take a few seconds and I'll finish. Because there are very few. But if you ask me how many lessons did you learn, I have a long list. We aimed to learn about evangelism to Muslims. And basically, in terms of contextualization. In other words, how can I help the Muslim maintain his form, his culture, but change his theology? How can he commit himself to Christ but still look Muslim, authentically look Muslim. And there's a danger. We found not everybody can do that. Only big people, I mean people that are already key people, influential people, head of a family, rather than a young man. Once a fellowship is established, the young man can join this group. But if a young man accepts the Lord, we encourage him to go and join the church and become churchian. But whenever we had a man that was able to influence others and not shaken easily and will not go into heresy, we encourage him to follow the contextualization approach. For instance, a Muslim feels it is insulting to God to sit on a chair and talk to God. For me, I can do it. I have no problem with that. But for him to feel that you're talking to the Almighty God as you're sitting at a chair, suppose President Bush comes to this room. And he's standing here, and he asks you a question, and you want to talk to him. Will you sit, putting one knee over the other, and talk to President Bush? If with a human being, it is a shame to sit as you talk to a man like that, how about the Almighty God? He feels the way to talk to God is to be on your knees. Not only that, to touch your, you know, the floor with your forehead. Now, who am I to tell him? You should become like the Protestants in order to become a Christian. Should I do that? Well, the first major problem that the church faced in the first century was, should the Gentile become a Jew and then become a Christian, or could he become a Christian directly? And I tell you, we could solve the problem in 2 minutes. It's very easy. But the early church, it was such a big deal. They had discussions, consultations, and finally a general council in Jerusalem. And you find a whole chapter almost in Acts 15 talking about this council. And finally, the decision was, no, the Gentile does not need to become a Jew first and then become a Christian. He could become a Christian directly. And I think we're facing the similar issue in Egypt today and in the Muslim world. How can we help the Muslim commit his life to Christ without becoming a churchian? I tell you, we learned so much, and I'm going to stop and not go more into this because I could spend the whole evening talking about that. But we discovered a fantastic truth that Muslims are not against Jesus Christ. They are against churchianity. And they have an Arabic word for it, is Nusrani. And when you heard the word Nusrani, it's repulsive. It's like becoming, you know, a traitor to the family, a traitor to the culture. Can you imagine a Muslim convert during the month of Ramadan when all his family is fasting? And suppose they are not really believers, but just out of tradition, they all fast. And they don't drink and they don't eat from 4 in the morning until, let's say, 7 at night. And then during the day, because he's a Christian now, he doesn't care for their feelings. He drinks, you know, in front of them. He eats while every... Boy, I tell you, he won't last long in that home. He looked like a traitor. I don't know if you know what I mean. But this is, you know, the culture is so powerful that it is not Jesus Christ who is the problem. It's the churchian culture. So, there are 8 men now. There were 8 men. Protestants that have decided to become missionaries to Muslims. We learned that we don't need to get missionaries from outside in Egypt because we have lots of people here. In other countries, it is needed to have people from outside. But rather than, let's say, somebody from the States or from England coming to Egypt, it takes him at least 6 to 8 years to become really good in the Arabic language because he's learning 2 languages, the classical Arabic and the written, the spoken Arabic. And I tell you, these are different. You speak one and you write another one. Yeah. So it will take him at least a minimum of 8 years to learn the language, and he will still have an accent. I lived for 15 years and I'm Lebanese, and I knew the written one and I had to learn the spoken one. And I tell you, from the second sentence, they could tell I am not Egyptian. My children speak like the Egyptians. When you are old, you can't but have an accent. Not only that, this person from the West, although he learns the language and suppose his accent is minimum, but still he has blue eyes and fair hair. Now we found we could have people from here that are already Egyptians. They don't need finances from outside in huge amounts. Their eyes are not blue, nor their hair is fair. They already know the culture. In their elementary education, they have memorized portions of the Quran as an obligatory, you know, required things in their Arabic courses. All it takes is two major decisions. One major decision is, are you willing to stay to the rest of your life in Egypt, even if an Islamic revolution takes place? And I tell you, that's tough. And many people in the last 3 years made that decision. 8 men made a second decision. Are you willing to become a missionary to these people? And we used to meet together, read the Bible, and read the Quran, and pray together, and pray for the contacts we have, discuss Islam, read the most difficult, the most convincing books written by Muslims, like I tell you, men like Al-Ghazali, and Muhammad Amara, and others. Boy, their books are very convincing. Some people think Islam will never arrive to the States. It won't be convincing except to the blacks, because it gives them dignity. I tell you, if these books are translated to English, you'll see how many white people among university students will begin turning to Islam. As I worked on my dissertation, it was on Islamic fundamentalism in Egypt. I read the books of these people in Arabic. I had the privilege of doing that because I knew the language. And in one chapter I was studying, it was about Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. My wife, for a certain time, I knew it later, was praying for me out of fear that I might become a Muslim. I wouldn't become a Muslim, but I tell you, I came to really respect them. Rather than hearing that he's making fun of me. Well, you know, for instance, just to mention to you, just an illustration, Hassan al-Banna was born in 1906. By the time he was 12 years old, he had memorized the whole Quran. Now, many children by that age memorize the whole Quran. The Quran is as big as the New Testament. Now, if we know of a Christian who has memorized the whole book of Romans, boy, we'd say he's a spiritual giant. Right? Now, many of them would have memorized the whole Quran. Now, Hassan al-Banna finished the Quran at the age of 12. He decided not to go to Al-Azhar Seminary, but to go to secular education. He wasn't impressed with the spiritual life of the people at the seminary, at the Muslim seminary. So he graduated from the school of education and became a teacher. 1928, he started his teaching work in Ismailiyah, a city by the Suez Canal. And from the first day, he started his evangelism and discipling ministry among Muslims. Now, as a navigator, I'm proud of concepts such as man-to-man, Paul-Timothy relationship, half a day or a day with the Lord, you name it, and I'm proud of it. The Campus Crusade are proud of the concepts they have, you know, everything, you know, the four spiritual laws, etc., etc., etc. The InterVarsity are proud of this and this and this, and you name it, and all churches have their own things, each one has their own distinctive. It's amazing, by the 1930s and 1940s, Hassan al-Banna was practicing all these things that we feel so proud of. We thought we invented them. By the early 1940s, he had 500,000 disciples in Egypt and another 500,000 adherents. He was assassinated in 1948. Now, he is the trunk of the tree out of which all Muslim fundamentalist groups come out. Some of them militants, others are not. There are, the last count I know, is 44 groups. Well, one of the misconceptions he had about Christianity is he thought that when Jesus said, give to Caesar what is unto Caesar and to God what is unto God, he thought Jesus meant that on Sunday live a good Christian life, but the rest of the week manipulate people, do anything you want to rise up in the hierarchy. Do live what the way you like the rest of the week, but on Sunday, especially during church time, be good, look good, be pious. He says, this is dualism, this is hypocrisy. He said, Islam means surrender, full surrender to God. Not an hour a week, not a day a week, every day of the week, every hour of the day. And he preached that and he tried to live that. Now, I am sad to say this was a misconception. When Jesus said, give me a coin, they gave him a coin. He said, whose image does it have? They said, the image of Caesar. He said, give that which has the image of Caesar to Caesar, and give that which has the image of God to God. Who has the image of God? Each one of us. So what Jesus was saying, give your taxes to the government without cheating, but give your total life to Christ because he owns you. You are created in his own image. You belong to him. It's not an hour a week. It's not a day a week. It's every day of the week. That's what Jesus meant. I wonder if we are partly, I mean we Christians are partly to blame for what Hassan al-Banna thought Jesus meant. Now you may wonder, why was I kicked out? Let me briefly finish here and then give you an opportunity for questions. The shortest way of saying it is by reading to you a couple of paragraphs from our latest newsletter. On September 12, on my second visit to the secret police in Egypt, after 2 hours of waiting, I was asked one question. I tell you, I was expecting an interrogation. You know, 30 questions, 40 questions. If they tell me this, I'll answer that. And if you know, and then the Holy Spirit who's within me will kind of help me what to say. I waited and waited and waited. Then he asked me one question. The question is, what is your relationship to Ghada Mustafa? This is the name of a woman. My answer was, I've never heard of her. The response was, you have 10 days to leave the country. So they took my passport and I had to get a ticket to prove that I was leaving Egypt. Only when I showed them that ticket, they gave me back the passport. Now I am on the blacklist. Ghada Mustafa was the wife of the ex-head of the parliament in Lebanon. She came from a very distinguished Muslim family, and she was converted to Christianity there in Lebanon, and thus was divorced. So she came to Egypt for a few weeks. All the time she was in Egypt, our family was in Cyprus, where I was finishing off the dissertation for my PhD. So I've never met her nor heard of her until that day. In Egypt, she was discipled in such a way that nourished her aggressiveness in evangelism to Islam. Instead of building bridges for the gospel like we believe in from the depth of our being, instead she attacked Islam and the Prophet non-stop. And since she came from such a distinguished Muslim family and was a magazine publisher, her contacts were all dignitaries. You know, she will meet with chief editors of newspapers, sometimes ministers in the cabinet, and attack Islam. You know, every boy, what a calling. Finally, she left Egypt on her own, yet her case needed to be closed. I was chosen as the scapegoat for a few reasons. Number one, I was Lebanese like her. It's always easier to kick out a foreigner rather than an Egyptian. Secondly, because of the Gulf crisis and fear of Islamic fundamentalism, the government was under tremendous pressure and needed to prove that they are even-handed with both Muslims and Christians. So not only many Muslims were put into prison, but some Christians as well were imprisoned, tortured, or expelled from the country. For instance, a man similar to my situation, he's Syrian, I'm Lebanese. He's married to Australian, I'm married to an English woman. I work under the umbrella of the church, he chose not to. What they did with him is they took him to prison, put him there for 2 weeks, and from prison they wanted to take him straight to the airport. He begged them to allow him to see his family. They took him home and saw his wife and children for half an hour. In my case, I had 10 days. I had all the freedom in the world. You know, I knew the telephone was bugged, and every telephone conversation there was a third person. And man, you know, we were kind of talking about the Lord, you know, talking. They tell me, you know, we felt so bad about your leaving, etc. And I tell them, well, God is in control, you know. He's, you know, and then somebody will say, well, we want to give you a money gift. I say, well, the Egyptians need it far, far more than I do. And they say, no, we want to express our gratitude, you know, to the Lord for, you know. And I say, no, there are so many people in Egypt that need it, you know. And so we were talking all the time and with the third person giving him a message indirectly whenever it was appropriate. They had a reception for us. And the hall could take about 300. I don't know how they crammed 500 people into it. I'm sure there may be a representative of the secret police. The program was supposed to be 15 minutes singing, then 15 minutes sharing from the people, and then I preached my last sermon in Egypt for 1 hour. And as you see, I'm used to 1 hour kind of preaching. Well, still 10 minutes. Relax. Well, anyway, they did the singing, then the sharing, and they couldn't stop them. They kept sharing for 1 hour 45 minutes. When my time came, I said, when I attend funerals, I feel like I wish this man had the opportunity to hear the nice things that were said about him before he died. I said, I had the privilege of attending our funeral while I'm still alive. I tell you, you know, it was Barbara was crying, you know, I don't know how I controlled myself, but finally at the airport I crashed. But these 10 days were the busiest and most fulfilling days of my life. For instance, there was a particular young man that I discipled for a couple of years. And a few years ago, he did something to me that really hurt me very, very deeply. It was the hardest thing I experienced in Egypt. And I found it very hard to forgive him. And he never apologized. during this past year, I started praying differently. And I said, Lord, could it be that it's all his mistake? Maybe I have part of it, not all his problem. Well, I started praying, maybe I have 1%, and it increased to 10%, then it's maybe more. And then started asking God to forgive me, and asking God to give us an opportunity to talk together. And every time I see him, I tell him, how about meeting together sometime? He says, yes, I feel we need to, but once I finish this project, and I waited and I waited. Finally, when I had 10 days, I tell you, no more time to waste. I went to him. I didn't care whether he apologized to me or not. All I wanted is to ask his forgiveness for my part. And, you know, just to have a clear conscience with God and with people. Another illustration, and on the last day at the airport there, he was hugging me and telling me, like the good old days, closer than a brother. That was a good testimony to all those that were at the airport. Another thing is, 1 month before I left, or short time, you know, sometime in the summer before I left, I knew a pediatrician whom I was discipling, and then I heard that he was having a beginning of a sexual relationship with a woman. I knew the whole thing from the woman. And he didn't know that I did that. So we were meeting our normal time, and he started sharing with me, and I found he was lying. He was rationalizing. And then when I told him I knew, and I told him I know this, he said no. And I don't remember ever being harder on anybody like I was on him. And then he left our home with our relationship strained. And it continued strained until the 10 days I had to leave. And boy, I started praying, Lord, give me an opportunity to kind of restore my relationship with this man. But he didn't come to us. Partly he was afraid that, you know, secret police might see him coming to our home or something. And then one day we were going, my wife and I, with a couple to the Pizza Hut. We saw him with his family there. As I saw him, I said, thank you, Lord. I went to him and I said, Nabil, his name is like my name, could we just stand for 3 minutes and talk together? We went. I said, will you please forgive me for being so hard on you that day? He said, I want to tell you something. I wish you were harder. I deserved it. I was not repentant. And boy, what a different attitude. So there we were hugging one another at the airport. You know, fantastic 10 days. From 7 in the morning till 1 a.m., the telephone was either ringing or time with people. One particular fellow, 15 minutes only I had with him before somebody else comes. I start praying, Lord, this is the 15 minutes that I have, the last 15 minutes I may ever have with this man. Lord, what do you want me to talk with him? And we were talking superficial issues. And then I continue praying, Lord, how can I make this time valuable? What do you want me to talk with him about? And then I ask him, how's your marriage? Now I tell you, we had the best 12 minutes in 15 years. Well, coming to point three. A few months earlier, a book was written in Egypt by a young Christian scholar. He's like Kitty that wrote about Mrs. Reagan, nominal Christian scholar. He wrote a good book, but he needed to write names. He compared Islam with Christianity. He mentioned the name of several Christian leaders. I was mentioned as well. I was compared to a leader of Muslim fundamentalists. A month later, Al-Ahram newspaper, the largest newspaper in the Middle East, summarized that book. In 24 hours, I became famous, at least all over Egypt. The government knew that I was not dangerous. Otherwise, they would not have renewed my residency shortly after that in May. Yet after the Gulf crisis and Ghada Mustafa's visit to Cairo, I became a very convenient scapegoat. The government was confident that I was not the type who would ask hundreds and thousands in the West to write letters to their government questioning democracy in Egypt. And I think this is the main reason why I was chosen as the scapegoat. Because if I was going to be the type that will ask people to write letters, I will cause headaches. And some navigators asked me, shall we write letters? I said, oh no. Three lawyers volunteered to defend me free of charge. I discussed it with the team and they said, let's not do it. And we agreed on that. I didn't want to hurt Egypt. And I tell you, I left that country with no bitterness or resentment whatsoever, neither against the government nor against Islam. I understand why they had to do it. They had to be even-handed. They had to appear even-handed in both with Muslims and Christians. And as I was getting on the plane, there were two soldiers standing by the steps, the ladder leading up to the... I looked at them, they were Muslims, and they were smiling to me because I was smiling to them, and I said, Salamu alaikum. This is the way Muslims greet one another. And they said, Bis salama, may God's peace go with you, as they were smiling. And I tell you, as I looked at their faces, I loved Islam and Egypt in their faces. It was the greatest privilege of my life that God allowed me to be in that country for 15 years. What a privilege. Now, we are in the States. I need a nationality very badly because Lebanon, I have left it since 1975. And Egypt, I'm kicked out of it. So I'm a man with no country of residence. So England, I have a tourist visa. The States, I have a visitor's visa. But now I'm changing it to a status that allows me to work. And so I need another nationality. So the navigator leadership advised me, and I was in agreement fully with this suggestion, that I should take the Canadian nationality, because in the Middle East it will be more acceptable than the American or the British nationality. And the plan is to go for 4 years to Canada, take the Canadian nationality, then return and be available to the navigators for 10 years or whatever God allows me to do, so that I'll help the navs in Muslim countries, maybe through a traveling ministry, in understanding Islam and respecting it. I'm finding that people here in the States could have one of two attitudes. The first one is described this way. You start with ignorance. With it comes fear, because they are militant, and the fastest spreading religion in the world, their aim for this coming generation is to increase from 8 million to 50 or 70 million Muslims in the United States alone. Their aim also is to make England an Islamic Republic. London is their beachhead for Europe, and they have world vision. They are the fastest growing religion in the world. So we start with ignorance, fear, prejudice, and judgmental attitude with stereotypes. We make it easy and rationalize to ourselves, and we say they are terrorists, or they are Arabs, or whatever we might call them, you know, and kind of push the responsibility on somebody else. And imagine the Great Commission, the whole world minus Islam. That's not the Great Commission. That's not the Great Commission. The Great Commission includes Muslims. And only 2% out of all Christian workers in the world are working with 1/3 of all the unreached people in the world. Is that fair? It is not fair. God loves them too, you know. Now, the different attitude could be, start with real desire to understand them and know them. Secondly, this will lead, I tell you, it will definitely lead to respect. And respect many times is followed by compassion to the people you get to know. Then evangelism. Evangelism here is not really evangelism. It's twisting the arm of the person and winning an argument. And when that person accepts Christ, he hates his past, and he becomes a socially dislocated person. Now, the plan is to go to Toronto and stay there for 4 years and work with an Egyptian church that invited me. My main ministry will be, along with my wife, with couples. They have, I heard, about 100 couples. Many of them, or some of them, were in our ministry in Egypt. So when we visited in February, boy, we felt at home. You know, I felt like fish back in the water. Speaking Egyptian, talking Egyptian jokes at night as usual in conferences, singing in Arabic. And the only different thing is snow as you look from the window. Well, we hope, I hope that God will give us the desires of our heart, that Barbara and I will try a couples ministry with Muslims in Toronto through these Egyptian Christian couples. Through them, maybe they'll invite some couples, Muslims, to a small group couples ministry. And we talk about marriage, and because we find in Egypt this is really the felt need among the Christians. Most probably it's among the Muslims too. And we talk about God rather than talking about Christ. Once we find a couple that are eager and open, we take them to the side and do with them an evangelistic Bible study. So I'll be preaching, but mainly our ministry will be couples ministry that I hope will lead to a Muslim ministry. Later on, coming back, maybe to Colorado Springs and have a visiting ministry into countries like Pakistan, Nigeria, and other countries to help navigator teams with their ministries. Let me conclude with this. I started by that man that committed himself to pray almost daily for a year. Now, you remember the story of Moses and Joshua? Moses' arms were lifted up, and as his arms were lifted up, Joshua was fighting and he was doing well. Whenever Moses got tired, and I tell you, try to do like this for an hour or two, And you'll feel your arms are about, each one about, I don't know how many pounds, I know in kilos. Each one about 20 or 30 kilos. They become so heavy. And man, the longer it's, the harder it becomes. But when he got really tired and his arms got down, many people got wounded or killed back there. And then he'll raise up his arms again. Now, we could have a partnership. You know? And I want to give a similar invitation that I gave years ago in 1988 and every time I come here. Are you willing to commit yourself to pray for Samuel or for our family almost daily for 1 year? If you're interested, after the meeting, come and write your name in capital letters so I'll understand, you know, I can read your handwriting. And next to your name with the address, etc., write Jabours, or if you don't, just NJ or Samuel, Sam. So I'll know who you're praying for. And I could tell you, those that want to pray for Samuel, I can tell you more private things that I don't like to say in public. Now there is, I took 1 hour, Jean. Isn't that amazing? Not more, but I want to have some time for questions.
Oh, yeah.
Would you like to stand up? Just to kind of...
Well, I'll tell you what let's do.
Let's push up the ceiling.
Are you ready?
Oh, make it go.
Now let's push out the walls. Now get it the other way. I believe we can make it now.
Yeah, thank you. You may be seated. I don't know how much time you might have. Maybe 10, 15 minutes. Any questions? Yeah.
In your respect for Islam and in your winning them and their commitment to God, how do you bridge that gap to make them see, though, that Jesus is God?
Yeah.
In other words, that to them would be abomination, I would think.
Yeah.
See, how do you get over to that, which is so crucial, the deity of Christ?
Okay, let me just mention something from their point of view. Let me put myself in their shoes and tell you how they see the main differences between us and them. They say, well, these Christians believe in a trinity, which is polytheism. How can God marry a woman called Mary and have a son called Jesus? This is blasphemy. God will not marry a woman and have a son. So they reject the trinity, and that's their concept of the trinity. And the church is responsible for it. That's the kind of church that they saw when Muhammad was a young man. Anyway, so they reject the trinity and they have a wrong concept of it. From that comes the second point. Of course, then Jesus cannot be the son of God, because how can God marry a woman and they have a son? But they respect him so highly, they say he is a great, one of the greatest prophets. He's the only prophet who's called the Spirit of God and the Word of God. The second step, or the third step that follows from that, they say, how can a good prophet like that be allowed to be crucified? They say, we love Jesus more than you do. How can a person be cursed hanging on a cross like this, like a criminal? Of course he was not crucified. God took him because he loves him so much and had somebody else on the cross that the people thought it was Jesus. And some of them think it was Judas that was on the cross. So they say, we love him more than you do. Now, if I know the background of their thinking, rather than attacking, I am more sympathetic to their point of view. That does not mean I agree with them. Now, Samuel, for instance, he has contacts with many, many people in his company, because his company that has thousands of workers is his mission field. 98% of them are Muslims. So he has contacts with all these people. And he, you know, I don't have the time to tell you what he does. But anyway, one of the things he does is that whenever he finds a devout Muslim, he tells him, and he becomes friends with him, he tells him, will you teach me about Islam so I'll see it from your point of view? Well, here's a free seminary course taught by a devout Muslim. And we find there are some Muslims that are hypocrites, some others are very, you know, very honest in their relationship with God. We find the hypocrites are the hardest people to relate to, whether Christians or Muslims. But people that are seeking really honestly to have a relationship with the Lord, it is fun to be with them. I used to think in the good old days, reach the secular among the Muslims. No, now I have a different point of view. Reach the honest seekers, the honest devout people. And you'll find you can learn from this man and learn from him, and really you're learning, and then sooner or later that man tells you, now you tell me about your religion. And I learned something from a book by Scott Peck. It's called Community. This man brings people together and tries to help them to accept one another and become a community. He says they go through various phases. Phase one is artificial politeness. Everybody is, you know, like suppose you have Christians and Muslims and Jews, you know, here in the States coming together for 3 days conference with a psychiatrist. And so the first phase is, you know, artificial politeness. The second one is dogmatism, and each one trying to convert the other person. Anarchy. Third step is a broken spirit. The person might begin wondering, what if I don't have the whole truth? What if the other person has something that I can learn from him? Humility, the third step. The fourth step, community. I say number five, evangelism. Now, if I go through these steps with a Muslim, I don't, you know, artificial politeness, and I don't need to go through the dogmatic stage. I can start with number three. A real humility, really desiring to see Islam from his perspective, and really praying, Lord, help me to have an increased respect for them. This will lead to real acceptance. And when there is acceptance, I tell you, they listen. Usually I postpone talking about the Trinity and the person of Christ and the crucifixion until the very end. I pull the carpet from under myself, not from under him. I used to, in Lebanon, try to win the argument. And then we might lead a person to the Lord, but we go to see him the next day. He doesn't want to see us. But with these people, for instance, I start with them in Acts chapter 10. And we spend many weeks in Acts chapter 10. The first time, we talk only about Peter, and we speak about his prejudice and his fanaticism. Then I give him a testimony how I was a fanatic and how God is changing me. Then the next session is about Cornelius, and we describe Cornelius, how he was, etc. And then we compare this man with Cornelius, and we say, you know, you're very much like Cornelius. So I'm attacking myself and I'm praising him. Then we say, what's the message that changed the life of Cornelius? And it's about 5-6 verses. We take for every verse about 3-4 chapters, cross references. Like Jesus went about doing good. We read several miracles, parables, you know, etc. Just as a cross-reference to this verse. So we spend in the sermon of Peter, you know, a long time. So by the time we have spent, it might be months, we come to the crucifixion. They are already, you know, kind of eager for it. For instance, one fellow called Amr, that I did this with him for a couple of years. When we reached to the topic of the Trinity, I said, okay, let's listen to a tape by the Patriarch of the Orthodox. Excellent tape in Arabic. And I said, all the questions you have, write them down. So he began writing, you know, and we listened to the first half. He said, shall we discuss? I said, let's listen to the second half. We finished the second half. I had said, what are your questions? He said, I don't have any questions. You Christians are the victims of being misunderstood. When I left him, he believed in the crucifixion. He believed, to some extent, beginning to believe in the Trinity or understand the Trinity. He had still some difficulty in believing that Jesus is God. But Samuel is continuing with him. And he's on his way. And he is an honest Muslim. Not those that do the black stuff here, you know, pretending that they are so pious and so religious because they prayed and the carpet touched their foreheads, they have a bruise now. We all know, and they know, that they do it with a stone or with some chemical. You know that Sadat used to have, or has had it? Whenever he visited the States, he put cream so it will not show. But when he went back to Egypt, he removed the cream so that the cameras can really show it. But I believe I might see him in heaven. He started that way. Anyway, this is just on the side. Any other comments? Or questions? Thank you for your willing to listen.